My name is Carl Bender. I wasn't sure what to call this course, so I gave it a very long name. I'm from Washington University in St. Louis. I hope you enjoy this. I gather you're from rather diverse backgrounds. Some of you know a lot of stuff, and some of you are sort of more in the nature of beginners. So please stop me if there's, you know, if you have questions or if I'm using terminology that you don't understand. In any case, let's see. What I want to talk about is a technique from that you will need to know how to use for your entire life. If you're becoming theoreticians, you're going to need to know how to sum a series. That's fundamental problem. That's basically what I'm going to explain to you how to do. Now, that sounds kind of trivial, but in fact, this is really very, very subtle. And the theory behind this is not even completely understood, not understood at all, actually, I should say. So, in fact, there are many theses, probably hundreds of theses, that need to be written between now and, in some sense, the end of this topic. So let me give you, let me begin by giving you an outline of what I'm going to be talking about. That's an outline of my talk. And so basically, why is it that you need to know how to sum a series? Well, because you're going to be solving problems. You're going to be doing research. And you're going to be doing research problems in physics. And there are only two ways, really, of attacking a very difficult physics problem. One of them is to use a computer and to try to do it numerically. And what I can tell you is that this is not usually, if you only use a computer, this is not at all recommended. This is really very, very unclear. And that's because a computer program is a little bit like a sausage. You don't know, you know, it looks fine until you find out what went into it, you know. You never know whether or not a computer program is working correctly. You simply don't know. And you need to have some sort of analytical way to attack a problem, okay? And the only way that I can teach you, the only thing that is known about attacking a hard problem is perturbation theory. And what I'm going to explain to you in a moment is that when you use a perturbation technique, what you end up with is a series. And you have to learn how to sum that series. Okay? And that's the reason why I'm teaching you this. So what I'm teaching you is of extremely broad interest. It doesn't matter whether or not you're going into theoretical particle physics or fluid dynamics or chemistry or engineering. It doesn't make the least bit of difference. When you have to solve a hard problem, you will use perturbation theory. And perturbation theory gives you a series. And that series has to be summed. Okay, so here's the basic idea. Suppose you have a hard problem, okay? A very, very hard problem. Almost, when I say a hard problem, I mean a problem where you can't write down right away an analytical solution. And this is the case with essentially every problem you will ever face in your life. If you can write down an analytical solution, the problem is trivial and no one is really going to be interested in it anyway. Okay, so you're interested in hard problems. So what is the approach of perturbation theory? The approach of perturbation theory is that you put in a small parameter that's called epsilon, okay? And you're going to regard epsilon as small, okay? That means epsilon is small compared with 1. It's a small number, okay? Now, at first, you may think that this complicates the problem, Because now, instead of having one hard problem, you have an infinite number of hard problems, one for each value of epsilon. But it turns out that makes the problem easy, much easier to solve. Okay. But what I should say is, inserting epsilon, that's the first thing that you have to do. That's the first step. The second step is to write down the answer to the problem, the answer, as a series in powers of epsilon. That's called the perturbation series. Okay, and you're going to develop the answer as a series in powers of epsilon using techniques that I'm going to show you. Okay, and the third step, so this is the second step here, number two, and the third step is to sum the series. You simply add up the series, and then you set epsilon equal to 1 to eliminate the epsilon that you put in at the beginning of the problem, and you're done. That's it. That's perturbation theory. And this is a technique that's used in every branch of physics, engineering, every branch of science. Okay, so those are the three basic steps of perturbation theory. Step one, you insert a small parameter epsilon. Step two, you expand the answer as a perturbation series in powers of epsilon. And step three, you take this answer that you've obtained, which is a series in powers of epsilon, and you sum the series. Well, it turns out that the first step is relatively, involves a certain amount of art, but it isn't all that difficult. Okay? And when you practice with a few problems, you'll see that it's not a terribly difficult thing to do. And step two, developing the perturbation series, that means calculating these coefficients. These are called perturbation coefficients, a sub n. That's relatively straightforward. It's not easy in the sense that it may take you a long time, and it's very tedious. It can be very tedious, but it isn't intellectually demanding. There's no difficulty in doing it. But step three, that's the hard part, and that's why I'm giving you a course. Okay? And in fact, the really interesting part of this course is that almost always this perturbation series turns out to be a divergent series. Okay, and this is what they don't teach you. How many of you, maybe I should ask you, how many of you have had courses in elementary quantum mechanics? Okay, so you've all had an elementary quantum course. And presumably one of the topics in the course, not the first topic, but probably somewhere in the second half of the course, they told you you can solve problems using perturbation methods or perturbation theory. Have they taught you that? Okay. Did they teach you, did they reveal to you the big secret? The big secret is that when you get a perturbation series, it's almost always divergent. Did they tell you that? Did they admit it? No, probably not. Yes, they did. You say, say it again. Yes, even in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, almost always the series is a divergent series. And so the question is, what are we going to do about that? If we can't sum the series, then there's no point in teaching you perturbation theory in the first place. Because why teach you something that generates a mathematical expression that you simply can't handle? It doesn't make sense. It's just a waste of time. Yeah? Does the series converge if epsilon is less than 1, you're asking?
I mean, your methods, right? As you set epsilon is small number less than 1.
Yes.
And now you count the third stage and set epsilon equal 1.
No, that's exactly what we will do. That is exactly what we're going to do. And almost always, the perturbation series has a zero radius of convergence. So even when epsilon is very small compared with 1, the series will still be divergent. Okay. And furthermore, I will show you that there is a physical interpretation for why the series has a zero radius of convergence, okay? And that this series is an asymptotic series. And this is deeply connected with the quantization and quantum mechanics. So I will explain all these things to you. This is a very, very subtle and interesting problem, okay? And an extremely general problem, okay? But I think it's important for me to illustrate, because I've just been talking in generalities, and I want to illustrate using a very simple case what I mean so that you'll see what I'm getting at, okay? So, so let's, first of all, let's think of a hard problem. To start simple, a hard problem is, say, that equation, okay? Why is that a hard problem? Well, we have a quadratic formula, and we also have a cubic formula, a formula for solving a cubic equation, Cartan's formula, right? So that's not a hard problem, okay? And it turns out we can also solve quartic polynomial equations, but we do not know how to solve a quintic equation or higher, okay? There is no formula, so I can't calculate x analytically. Of course, I can do it numerically using Newton's method, for example, but I cannot solve this problem analytically. So this is, by definition, a hard problem, okay? There is no known analytical solution to this problem, okay? So now what I want to do is solve the problem by putting in a, well, I want to solve the problem by using perturbation theory, okay? And I want to treat the problem by using perturbation theory. And I want to show you what I'm going to do. So here is the hard problem. I'm going to let's begin by telling you the answer. There is one real root to this equation, and that real root is 0.7548 7767, and so on. Okay? And the question is, can we calculate that as physicists? Can we attack a problem like that as a model hard problem? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to insert an epsilon over here. Now, that's not the only place where you can insert epsilon, but it's a good place to start, okay? And this is my choice, okay? So step one, I'm going to replace this problem by the problem over here. Okay, by the way, you can see that the root should be about 3/4. You can see that if you just draw a picture, if you just draw a graph of x to the 5 and a graph of x, lay them on top of one another, you ask, when does this sum pass through 1? You can see that x must be about 3/4, because if you take 3/4 and raise it to the 5th power and add on 3/4 again, you're going to get about 1. Okay, you can see that. Okay, so I have replaced the original problem by an infinite number of problems, one for each value of epsilon, which sounds like I've complicated the situation. Okay, but when I said before that step one involves a certain amount of art, do you understand where the art is? Why have I inserted an epsilon over here? Yeah. You were going to say, oh, you weren't going to say, okay. But that's, I can't see that far into the problem. But I insert an epsilon over here because when epsilon is equal to 0, now I can solve the problem. Okay? So I try to insert an epsilon such that when epsilon is equal to 0, this problem now becomes solvable. Okay? And it's clear that if I were to set epsilon equal to 0 here, I can solve x to the 5th equals 1. No problem. Okay? By the way, that would also be true if I put an epsilon in front of the x to the 5 term. Because when epsilon equals 0, again, I can solve the problem. Okay? But I don't want to talk about that yet. Okay? Because that will be one of the points that I'm going to make. Okay, so let's insert the epsilon over here. A physicist would call this a strong coupling expansion, but I will explain that to you later on. Okay, so I put in an epsilon, and I'm done with step one. Now I have to do step two. Okay, so I'm going to assume this is number one. Number two here, I'm going to assume that the answer is a series in powers of epsilon. Okay, so I'm going to assume that x of epsilon has the form A0 plus A1 epsilon plus A2 epsilon squared. This is a very powerful assumption, okay? And it may not necessarily be true, but I am making the assumption here. There are many other forms of a perturbation series that a perturbation series could take. Okay, but for now, I'm going to assume that this is the form of the perturbation series. Okay? So just a simple Taylor series. Okay? Now, we put in, using in step number one, we put in epsilon in such a way that the problem was exactly solvable. And therefore, it follows that what? What do we know about this series? A0 must be 1. Okay? So because the solution to this problem is, and by the way, when I set epsilon equals 0, this is called the unperturbed problem. That means that we are now talking about x of 0. And we know that the solution that we're looking for, x of 0, is 1. That tells me that a0 equals 1. Okay. But now we get to the boring secretarial bit of the problem. Okay, and that is to calculate the coefficients in the series. Okay, so the series really reads 1 plus A1 epsilon plus A2 epsilon squared and so on. Okay, now, what do we do next? Well, we take this series and we plug it into the problem and we compare order by order. We're going to reduce the problem to a sequence of equations in which we compare order by order and epsilon. Okay. And how do we do this? Well, we need to raise this series to the fifth power, and that's where the secretarial work comes in. So let's truncate the series. Let's just truncate the series to, say, three terms, okay, and ask, what is x of epsilon to the fifth power, 1 plus A1 epsilon plus A2 epsilon squared to the fifth power? Okay. Well, this is 1 plus, and now when you raise, so this is where the assumption that epsilon is small compared with 1 comes in. Why is this? Because I can assume that this thing here, because it's proportional to epsilon, is small, and when I expand it, I can expand it in a binomial expansion, right? So it's this plus this times 5 plus 5 times 4, 5 times 4 over 2 factorial, times this thing squared plus, and so on, 5 times 4 times 3 over 3 factorial cubed. So this is the binomial expansion that I'm using, right? Is that clear? So this is equal to 1 plus 5 times this, 5 times A1 epsilon plus A2 epsilon squared, okay, plus 5 times 4 is 20 over 2 is 10, times this expression squared. And if I square this expression, I get A1 squared epsilon squared, okay? Notice I'm throwing away all the higher powers of epsilon. Okay? Is that clear? Are you all with me? Okay, stop me if this is... Okay, so that says that this is equal to 1 plus 5a1 epsilon plus epsilon squared times the quantity 5a2 plus 10a1 squared. Okay? Plus higher powers. Okay? So now that's busy work. Let's go back here. Okay. So now let's evaluate, let's see what this equation says. This equation says that 1 plus 5a1 epsilon plus epsilon squared times 5a2 plus 10a1 squared, okay, plus epsilon times this. So it's plus epsilon plus A1 epsilon squared is all of that is equal to 1. And now I compare powers of epsilon, okay, and I notice that the first thing I notice is that the coefficient of epsilon to the 0 is already a true equation. You notice that the coefficient of epsilon to the 0 is the same on both sides. Oh, by the way, what justifies the fact that I can compare powers of epsilon on both sides of the equation? But can you say it a little bit more precisely than that? No, it's because the coefficients of a Taylor series are unique. That's why. Okay? The coefficients of a Taylor series are unique, and this is a Taylor series in powers of epsilon. At least it's assumed to be a Taylor series. We don't know that it's a Taylor series, but it's assumed to be. Okay? Yeah. Say it again. So a Taylor series, okay, so this is a term that you use in freshman calculus, Taylor series. However, you don't really understand what a Taylor series is until you take complex variables. So a Taylor series is a structure of the form, let's put it here. Taylor series is a structure of the form A sub n x minus A to the n. That's a Taylor series. In this case, A is equal to 0, and x is what I'm calling epsilon, okay? And this is a Taylor series if it converges. Okay, so it must converge. And if it converges, it always converges in a circle in the complex epsilon plane. Okay, and that circle, the radius of that circle is called the radius of convergence of a Taylor series. So it is, so a Taylor series is two things. One, it is a structure of this form, n equals 0 to infinity, okay, where this is some thing that we could call x, or, you know, this is the parameter, okay? So a Taylor series, number one, is something that has that structure, and number two, it must converge. If it doesn't converge, although it looks like a Taylor series, it's not a Taylor series. People like to call it a formal Taylor series, but what it really is an asymptotic series, okay? So that's what a Taylor series is. So we are assuming that it's a Taylor series. But we don't know if it converges. We don't know that. So we have no way of knowing because we don't know the answer yet. So this is an assumption. Okay, so to begin with, the coefficient of epsilon. So because the coefficients of a Taylor series are unique, we can write down now a series of algebraic equations, one for each coefficient. So the coefficient of epsilon to the first power is, from here, 5a1 epsilon, well, 5a1. And here, it's 1, and that's equal to 0. Okay? The coefficient of epsilon to the second power is 5a2, that's this term here, plus 10 A1 squared, that's that term here, plus A1, that's this term, is equal to 0. And it's clear to you, I hope it's clear to you, that we could go on like this. And going on, if I insisted that we went on, you realize you're too advanced to do stuff like this. You can teach a junior high school kid to go on. Okay, this is just busy work, secretarial work. So it's boring, okay? But we can do it, okay? But the point here is I'm making a very, very deep, a really, really profound point here. Because do you notice what we have done? We have begun with an infinitely hard problem. And by using perturbation theory, we have converted the problem into an infinite sequence of trivial problems. That's what perturbation theory does, and that's why it works, and that's why you are taught perturbation theory. Okay. Now, when I say trivial, I don't mean trivial in the sense that you can solve them in a second. It may take, in real life, in modern physics problems, it may take you weeks and weeks and weeks to solve each of these equations, it might even take you a week to solve the first equation, and a year to solve the second equation, and 10 years to solve the third equation, and so on. Okay, that's entirely possible. But what I'm emphasizing is that there isn't anything deep here. You can do it given enough time. And we have plenty of time here. So the solution to this problem is A1 is equal to minus 1/5. And if you plug in minus 1/5 into the second equation, it becomes 5A2 plus 10A1 squared is 10/25. And A1 is minus 1/5, which is minus 5/25, is equal to 0. And so A2 is equal to minus 1/25. OK? So A1, so let me review. A1 is minus 1/5. A2 is minus 1/25. Can you guess A3? A3 is, what did you guess? Minus 125? You're right. Can you guess A4?
625?
No, you're wrong. Ha! Gotcha. Okay, so it just so happens that the first three coefficients, I picked this problem because the first three coefficients are easy to remember. However, those are the first three coefficients. So we have, as far as we're concerned, we have completed step two of the problem. And now we're up to step three. So okay, so that's how the perturbation series begins, okay? And now, to complete the problem, we merely have to sum the series to get the answer. So we recover the original problem when epsilon is equal to 1, okay? And if we set epsilon equals 1, we have to sum the series 1 minus 1/5 minus 1/25 minus 1/25, okay? And 1/5 is 0.2, and 1/25 is 0.04, and 1/25, therefore, is 0.008. Okay, and you can see that's why I picked this problem, because it comes out easily. So the answer should be 1 minus 0.248, which is 0.752. Okay, so for the amount of calculation we did, we got minus. We got 0.752, and the correct answer is 0.755. So we're off by 3 parts in 750, 3 parts in 750, or 1 part in 250. Okay. So our answer is correct to a small fraction of 1% from no calculation. Okay, I mean, this was trivial. Okay, so perturbation theory makes you extremely powerful. However, the question is, was it justified to do what we did? Okay, now I'm not going to prove it to you now. Okay, but the radius of convergence, the big question is, what is the radius of convergence of this? And is this a Taylor series? The answer is, yes, it is a Taylor series. And the radius of convergence is about, well, 1.7 or 1.8. Okay. So were we justified in setting epsilon equal to 1 at the end? Yes, we were, because the series was convergent, and that's really wonderful. let me just review what this looks like. Here are the equations that we derived. If you continued the busy work, this would be the next equation. You notice it's getting messier. This would be the next one, and so on. It's getting quite messy. Here are the coefficients, minus a fifth, minus a 25th, minus 125th. The next one happens to be 0, which is not something you could have guessed. And the next one is 21 over 15625, okay, which is not something you could have guessed. And these coefficients are getting more and more complicated, okay? And that's because this is really a complicated problem. This is a very hard problem. And these are non-trivial coefficients, okay? However, the radius of convergence is bigger than 1, and it was justified to set epsilon equal to 0 at the end. Okay? Now, I could have put epsilon into the problem in a different way. And by the way, here is the perturbation series. When we sum the series, so this is the radius of convergence, 1.64938. So we got away with murder here. We were very lucky that epsilon equals 1 was inside the region where the Taylor series converged. If you did all of these terms in the series, which I wasn't going to trouble you with, the answer that you get to sixth order and perturbation theory is 75434. And the answer to the problem is 75488. So this is really wonderful. Okay? But here's another way to insert epsilon. And I think this, oh, good. Okay, so here's another way. Suppose we put epsilon over here. A physicist would call this a weak coupling expansion. Okay. The perturbation series now has this form. And if we sum the series at epsilon equals 1, because the radius of convergence of this perturbation series is now 0.08, if we set epsilon equals 1, the answer we get using perturbation theory is 21,476 instead of 3/4. Do you see the problem? In fact, this is the generic problem. This is, in fact, what almost always happens in physics. I mean, what I showed you that seemed to succeed, namely this calculation over here, is a set of measure 0 of possibilities. Okay, this almost never happens, that perturbation theory works so well. Typically, what happens in perturbation theory is that you're outside the radius of convergence of the Taylor series, and when you plug in epsilon equals 1, you get 21,476 when you're trying to calculate 3/4. That's the reason why I'm giving you this course, okay? And I think this is what I've done now. I've motivated this course, and we have to figure out what to do. Now, it turns out that divergent series are much, much more common than convergent series. And divergent series are not bad. Divergent series are good. Why are divergent series good? Because they converge to the answer much faster than convergent series. And that sounds like a contradiction in terms. Okay? So we love divergent series because we can extract the information from a convergent series much faster and much more easily than we can from a divergent series. So this sounds really weird. And this is the reason why we do perturbation theory in physics, because we can extract the information from a series even though the series is not a convergent series. Okay? So the conclusion is that we need to learn how to sum a series. And that's what this course is going to be about, how to sum a series. And it's really going to be in two parts. The first thing I'm going to show you is how to sum a series if the series converges. Because you might think, that seems silly. Why would you need to learn how to sum a series if it converges? If it converges, all you have to do is add it up. I mean, if it converges, you put it on a computer. If you add it up, If there are only 10 terms, you can add it up. But if there are 10,000 terms, it doesn't matter. You put it on a computer and have your computer add it up. Right? Wrong. Because very often, as you're going to see, the series, even though it's convergent, is a very, very slowly convergent series. In fact, it may converge so slowly, so incredibly slowly, that you can never extract the information from the series, which is quite remarkable, but it's true. Okay, so this is really interesting, and I'm going to show you lots of examples of series of this sort, where the information is there, but you can't get it out of the series. So what you have to learn is how to extract the information from the series efficiently. Okay? And one of the nicest examples that I'm going to show you is the use of a Fourier series to solve a problem. I'm going to show you that Fourier series are wonderful things. Okay? And part of this course is going to be about Fourier series. They're wonderful things. They work when Taylor series absolutely fail to work. Okay? But the problem with a Fourier series is that it is extremely slowly convergent. And after you have expressed the answer in terms of a Fourier series, when you try to extract the information from a Fourier series, you can't do it until you've had this course. And then you're going to find that you can accelerate, you can do what is called acceleration of convergence, and you can extract the information from the Fourier series that's hiding there. Okay, and this is a really powerful technique. Okay? The second thing that we're going to learn to do is to sum a series when it's divergent. That is, when it doesn't even converge at all. What I'm going to show you is that the information is not only there, but it is very easily accessible. Even though the series, if you try to add it up, equals infinity, we will be able to extract the information from the series without actually directly adding it up. And we will see that the information can be pulled out of the series very, very rapidly. In fact, a divergent series is much more useful to us than a convergent series. Okay? Now, I just want to point out that there is another way to insert epsilon. You might have thought that I showed you the only two ways of putting in epsilon here. Okay, in the example that I worked out for you, what I first did was to put epsilon over here. And it worked. And we got the answer with a lot of accuracy. And the second thing I did was to put an epsilon over here. But this is certainly not the only way to insert an epsilon. You can be really clever in the way in which you insert epsilon. What you can say is, you can ask yourself, why is this problem hard? It's hard because this is a nonlinear problem. X to the 5 is not x to the 1. If this were x to the 1 here, this would be a linear equation, and the equation would offer no problem whatsoever. So why don't we put an epsilon into this problem in the following way? Let's call it x to the 1 plus epsilon plus x equals 1. Okay? It's not obvious. So as I said before, step one when you do perturbation theory can involve a fantastic amount of cleverness and art. And this is a very interesting and a very clever way of putting epsilon into the problem. What does epsilon measure here? Epsilon measures how nonlinear the problem is. Of course, at the end of the problem, what do? We set epsilon equal to 4. Okay, to recover the original problem that we were trying to solve. Okay, but we can still treat epsilon as being small, and we can try to extract the answer. And it turns out, of the three techniques, this is the best. Okay, so where is a more sophisticated example where you might use a technique like this? Well, where epsilon is used to measure how nonlinear the problem is, well, an example would be, say, this equation. Okay, this is a very famous differential equation. This problem, does anybody know what this problem is called? Let me give you the complete problem. This is a differential equation boundary value problem where the boundary conditions are y of 0 equals 1 and y of infinity is equal to 0. Anybody seen this problem before? You have. It's, no, what did you, somebody said. Yeah, you saw it. It's what? Yes. Yes, so it is describing the charge density. Very, very, very good. Very good. Very, very good. That's right. Yeah, and do you know what this is? Do you know the name of this equation? This is the Thomas Fermi equation. And so this describes the charge density in a nucleus. It's not important that this is not, you know, the fact that it describes that right now is not the important thing to us. But the point is, this problem is a very, very difficult problem. Nobody knows how to solve this problem analytically. Even though it's just a second-order differential equation, nobody knows how to solve this differential equation because it's not linear. It's not a Bessel. Somebody said Bessel equation here, but yeah. But this is not a Bessel equation because you notice that the dependent variable y is raised to the 3/2 power, so it's nonlinear. Bessel equation is linear, and what is difficult about this problem is that it is nonlinear. And the reason it's not only difficult to solve analytically, in fact, I shouldn't say difficult, I should say impossible. Nobody has ever come up with an analytical solution to this problem. I don't know if it's been proved that there isn't one, but no one's ever found one. Let's put it that way, okay? This problem here, okay, this problem is not only difficult to solve analytically, it's very difficult to solve numerically. So if I said to you, look, we're just looking for a solution that starts at 1 and ends at 0. And I can even show you what the solution looks like roughly. Here's the x-axis. This is y. Here's y equals 1. And the solution just looks like this. It just represents a distribution of charge. And you can see that the charge distribution falls off to 0 at infinity. It's no big deal, right? It's a nice, smooth function. Okay, but if you try to solve it on a computer, you will find that you'll have a devil of a time. And the reason is that the equation is unstable. And if you give your computer the initial condition 1, you don't know what slope. Remember, this is a second-order differential equation. If you're going to integrate, you've got to give the computer an initial value and an initial slope. But you don't know what the initial slope is. So you guess. And if you guess a little bit too high, the solution goes down like this, and then it goes and blows up. And if you're a little too low, the solution goes down like this, and then it blows up. Okay? And it's really, really very difficult to solve this problem. And what you have to do is shoot. Okay? You have to keep trying. You have to get the solution to exist further. And further and further and further. And finding the slope is extremely difficult. Yeah? No, because the same thing happens. If you start at infinity, you see, if you start, you can't start, of course, at infinity because computers can only deal with finite numbers. What you can do is find the asymptotic behavior at infinity. Okay? And you can start over here and integrate backward. But you can never get all the way back to 1. Because, turns out, nonlinear problems typically have what is called spontaneous singularities, or movable singularities. And if you try to integrate back, okay, you will hit these singularities. Now, you can use global numerical methods, and that will work. Okay, you can use, there are various techniques, which I won't go into here, okay, where you can break the x-axis into patches and attach the patches together and so on. But the question is, how can we attack a problem like this analytically? Okay, what can we do to attack this problem? So here's what I suggest. I suggest we look at this problem and we say, can we put an epsilon into this problem in a clever way? Let's consider solving this problem. Okay, you see what I've done. I've said, let's put an epsilon into this problem here. And you see what epsilon is measuring. Epsilon is measuring how nonlinear this problem is. So there's a meaning to this perturbation parameter. It says to you how nonlinear the problem is. Okay. Of course, the question is, remember, in step one, we have to insert an epsilon into this problem in such a way that the problem is solvable analytically when epsilon equals zero. We have to be able to solve the unperturbed problem. And the unperturbed problem is the problem y prime prime equals y, subject to the boundary condition that y of 0 equals 1 and y of infinity is equal to 0. And you know what the solution, let's just verify, you do know what the solution to that problem is, right? Which is what? E to the minus x. Okay. So y naught is equal to e to the minus x. And when we want to solve this problem, okay, and by the way, you notice it looks just like that. Okay, so y naught is very close to the solution that we're looking for. And therefore, a perturbation expansion would have the form y of x is equal to e to the minus x plus epsilon y1 plus epsilon squared y2, and so on. And on the back of an envelope, you can calculate several more terms in this perturbation series. Okay, it's relatively routine. And if you do that, you will find the solution to the Thomas Fermi equation with tremendous accuracy. Okay, so perturbation theory makes you very powerful. Yeah?
How was this equation solved by Thomas and Fermi?
Oh, they solved it. Yeah, I'm not actually sure what technique they used. They probably used a relaxation method, okay, numerically, okay. Because this is, you understand, this is a very tough problem because this is a global, this is not a local problem, this is a global problem. And that's because it's a boundary value problem. This is a non-trivial problem to solve. So it was solved, I assume, numerically using relaxation techniques, okay. So, one other remark before we go on, and that is that an example, a very nice example, would be an equation like this. Does somebody know what that equation is? What is that called? Can you see it? I wrote that maybe too small. Ut plus uux plus u triple x equals 0. This is a nonlinear wave equation. It's the KdV equation. Yeah, OK. So this is the KdV equation. That stands for Korteweg-de Vries equation. The Korteweg-de Vries equation has. What's that? Is that your name? De Vries? It's not a relation, is it?
No, it's a really, really common question.
It's a common name. Okay. Okay. So this is the Korteweg de Vries. Who knows? Maybe. No, never. The KdV equation describes nonlinear waves. It describes shallow water waves. It is an extremely important equation because it has solutions that are called solitons. The Nobel Prize in Physics this year was given for transmission of waves through light fibers using solitons. Okay, and this is an extraordinarily important equation. It is a nonlinear differential equation. It is very, very hard to solve this equation. But if you were looking for a perturbative solution to this equation, a very neat thing to do would be to say the following. Look, what is it about this equation that makes it difficult? What makes it difficult is that it's nonlinear. So let's treat this equation perturbatively by writing down ut plus u to the epsilon ux plus u xxx equals 0. The question is, when epsilon is equal to 0, can we now solve this equation? And the answer is yes, because for epsilon equals 0, the equation reads ut plus ux plus u triple x equals 0, and that equation can be solved by a Fourier transform. Okay, so you can solve the equation, the equation when epsilon is equal to 0, can solve that analytically, and therefore you can develop a perturbation expansion, and this makes you powerful. Okay, so I'm trying to basically use this lecture to advertise what it is I'm going to be talking about in this course, and I want to give you one more example, which is one of my favorite examples. Say it again?
Can you see the solid form?
That's an interesting question. You may be able to, but you may not. Okay, it's not always true, and you may have to use summation techniques before you can see the solitons. And the reason is, this is a very good question, because the solitons are inherently non-perturbative. Okay, non-perturbative effects. Okay, but it's an interesting question. In fact, that would be a very nice thesis project to see if the solitons can be recovered in that perturbation expansion and whether or not those are truly non-perturbative effects. That is, whether you have to go to all orders in perturbation theory to see them or not. It's an interesting question. Okay, what you can do is use that perturbation expansion to see, to understand the short time behavior of the solution to the equation. So in other words, if I give you an arbitrary initial condition and allow the equation to evolve for 1 second, what does the solution look like? If I use this perturbation technique, it will work beautifully. Okay, but whether or not I will see a soliton which maintains its shape, that's not obvious. That's a very interesting question. Good point. Okay. Okay, so the question, so I want to give you one more example of using a perturbation expansion. And in fact, this is an answer to a question that somebody asked me before, and that is, can I use perturbation theory in non-relativistic quantum mechanics? And let's do an example. Let's use an example in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So a standard example is this problem here. What is this? Well, first of all, suppose this term were not present. What is this differential equation? It's the Schrodinger equation for what? For the harmonic oscillator, OK? So you notice that this is an x to the 4 term. So this is the Schrodinger equation for the anharmonic oscillator. It is subject to boundary conditions, namely y of plus or minus infinity is equal to 0. And the question is here, the straightforward question is, what are the energy eigenvalues E? OK, this is a very important problem in virtually every field of physics, ranging from atomic physics to particle physics. It's an extremely important problem. And that's because this is a model quantum field theory, very simple example of a quantum field theory. It's a really, really important problem. And nobody knows an analytical solution to this problem. Actually, many people have tried to find an analytical solution to this problem because the differential equation is linear, and you might think you might possibly be able to make some progress. At one point, somebody actually published a paper claiming that they had been able to find a solution to this equation in terms of elliptic functions. And they published it. And then someone actually checked this complicated solution that they wrote down, which contained elliptic functions. And by using various identities, they simplified it. And they simplified it further and further. Yes, you got it. And it turned out that the solution they found was zero. Okay, which was not wrong. It was not even wrong, because zero is a solution to that equation. Okay, because it's linear. Okay, but it wasn't useful, let's put it that way. Okay, so the question is, this is a terrifically good model problem to study when you're studying perturbation problems, and that's the natural place to put an epsilon. Why? Because when epsilon is equal to zero, the problem reduces to the equation for the harmonic oscillator, and the quantum harmonic oscillator is one of the few examples of a quantum problem, a non-relativistic quantum problem, that you can solve exactly. So it satisfies all the conditions of a perturbation expansion, okay? And now the question is, I'm going to jazz up this problem a little bit, because there happens, normally, people like to put a factor of 2 over here and a factor of 2 over there, and I like to put a factor of 4 over there. But that has nothing to do with the main point that I'm explaining to you. Okay, so now you know what the solution to the equation is when epsilon equals 0. When epsilon equals 0, you're solving just this differential equation, and the solution is what? What is the solution to this equation when epsilon equals 0? It's just what? Not just a Hermite. It's a Gaussian times a Hermite. Okay. So the solution y of x is a Gaussian. It's an e to the minus some constant times x squared times a Hermite polynomial of x. And the degree of the Hermite polynomial is n. And that corresponds to the nth, that gives you the nth eigenvalue, and the nth eigenvalue is calculable for all n. Okay. If we tried to solve this problem, however, when epsilon is non-zero, that's not a solvable problem, but we can develop a perturbation expansion. Except now we have a double perturbation expansion. We have to assume that y of x, that is the eigenfunction we're looking for, is a series, sum from n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n, times y sub n of x, okay, where this is y0. Okay, this is the unperturbed problem, okay, that we can solve. But we also have to assume a perturbation expansion for the eigenvalue, and it has the form sum from n equals 0 to infinity, epsilon to the n times e sub n of x. Okay? And we can compare, we can plug this in, we can solve order by order and powers of epsilon. Yeah, you have a question.
What does the n depend on x?
I'm sorry. I was just looking at this line in writing. Thank you. This indicates the dangers of drinking and deriving. Okay, so what you can do now is compare order by order and powers of epsilon. And what you will find is that these coefficients, e sub n, are growing rapidly with n. So E0 may be equal to just 1/2. That is, if we're talking about the ground state, this would be the ground state energy of the harmonic oscillator. And E1 typically is of order 1. It may be, for example, 3/4. E2 will come out to be something like minus 21/8. You notice that it's negative, but it's quite a bit bigger. E3 is equal to 333/16, which is still bigger, okay, and it's positive now. And in fact, This series is an alternating series. The only part that is not alternating is that the first two terms are positive. But then afterward, it goes plus, minus, and so on. But the series coefficients get very big very rapidly, okay? And in fact, E75, if you calculate that, turns out to be something like, I don't know, 10 to the 100, some very big number. And yes, you've guessed it. This is a rapidly divergent series. And this is typically what happens in physics. In fact, it turns out that, let's put it here. Turns out that E sub n is approximately, for large n, it goes roughly like n factorial times 3 to the n times minus 1 to the n plus 1, because it's alternating in sign, okay, times some constant, and there is some algebraic behavior, okay, which is n to some alpha, which is not so important. But the key thing is that the nth term is growing like n factorial. And that means that this perturbation expansion here, this guy, that we've assumed for the energy, converges for no value of epsilon. Okay? Now, when I started out this lecture, I showed you this example of a polynomial equation, and we were trying to solve the polynomial equation. And what I showed you was that even in the case where it didn't work, there was a finite radius of convergence. Remember, the radius of convergence turned out to be 0.08. So there was some value of epsilon for which there was a convergence. But here, there is no value of epsilon except epsilon equals 0. But epsilon equals 0 is the unperturbed problem, and that's the problem we are not interested in. Okay? So this series diverges for all epsilon. And the question is, what are we going to do? So you understand that in somebody gives you this problem and says, solve it, you have the clever idea of attacking the problem by using perturbation theory, and you insert an epsilon. And in good faith, you took a course in perturbation theory, in good faith, you proceed, and you calculate, say, 75 terms in perturbation theory, hoping that it will be useful to you. And in the end, you get a perturbation series that has a zero radius of convergence. And the question is, how do you ever extract the physics? And one very interesting question is, really, why does the perturbation series diverge? Is there a physical reason for why the perturbation series diverges? Not just, it's just not a mathematical fact, but is there a reason? The answer is, there is a reason, and it is wonderful. And that will be one of the surprises that I will save for you in this course, because the reason is quite extraordinary. It's really amazing why the perturbation series diverges. But the question, the matter of fact question is, how do we get the information out of the perturbation series if the series is divergent? So what I'm going to be showing you, let me see. I've told you a little bit about the anharmonic oscillator, okay? So what I want to show you just before we quit is a detailed outline of what I'm going to cover in this course. So here is an outline of the course. I hope that's useful. Okay. Just kidding. So the course, as I sort of mentioned before, is going to be in two parts. First, I'm going to tell you about how you accelerate the convergence of a series that does converge and extract the information quickly. And what I'm going to be teaching you among the techniques is the Shank's transform, which is a very, very powerful technique for extracting the sum of a series that is taking forever to converge. And in fact, what I will claim, just as an example, I'm not going to tell you how to do it today, but as an example, suppose you had the series 1 minus a half plus a third minus a quarter, and so on. What is the sum of that series?
Log 2.
Log 2, okay. In fact, if you wanted to calculate log 2 by summing that series, you could never do it. It doesn't even matter whether you have a supercomputer. You could never get a reasonable answer. Never. It's absolutely hopeless. Okay? In fact, you could let your computer run all night, and you would be lucky to get about 5 or 6 decimal places accuracy. Okay? It's just hopeless. You cannot sum this series. And yet, the terms in this series, this number, 1/2, 1/3, 1/4, they know what the answer is. And I'm going to show you how to get something like, say, 15-place accuracy from just the first 15 numbers in the series. Because the first 15 numbers of the series, they really know what the answer is supposed to be. But you have to tickle the answer out of them. Okay? So you have to convince the series to tell you what the answer is. And the Shanks transformation will tell you how to do that. Okay? Now, another example of a series that is very slowly converging is 1 + 1/4 + 1/9 + 1/16, and so on. The sums of the reciprocals of the squares. What is the sum of this series? Pi squared over 6. Very good. Very, very good. This is zeta of 2. That's correct. Very, very good. However, if you wanted to calculate pi by summing this series, you would be crazy. Okay? You can't do that. Now, this series converges. There's no question, just like the first series. This series here, this is log of 2. This series, of course, converges. There's no question that the series converges. But if you were to try to use your computer to sum the series, it would be, you would never get to the answer. You would never have an answer that you would be interested in. Why is that? Because this is what's known as, this is an example of a slowly converging series. Okay, what do I mean by slowly converging series? Well, let's suppose your computer can sum the series from n equals 1 to capital N. You can calculate the partial sum of 1 over n squared. But what your computer has not calculated is the sum from n plus 1 up to infinity of 1 over n squared. That's the difference between the partial sum and the exact answer to the series. Okay? Now, what is this? This is, roughly speaking, this guy is, roughly speaking, we don't have to write it as a sum. We could approximate it by an integral, right, from about n to infinity of 1 over x squared dx. And so this is of order, this is 1 over n. So the error after summing n terms in that series is of order 1 over n, the difference between your partial sum. So if your computer is a pretty fast computer, well, if you hire a high school student and you pay them a lot, and they work all night, okay, maybe they can calculate correctly the sum of, say, 1,000 terms. And the guy's worked all night, wakes up in the morning, and you only know the answer if you've calculated 1,000 terms to 3 places. If you use a computer, maybe you can sum 1 billion terms. But then you only know the answer to 9 places, which is terrible. And if you wanted to know the answer, say, to 20 places, it's completely hopeless. No computer could do that. And yet, what I claim is just the first 10 numbers in this series know the answer. They know what the answer is going to be. And I'm going to show you, using Richardson extrapolation, how to do that, how to extract the answer just using a pencil and paper, okay, and a pocket calculator, which is quite remarkable. So in other words, what I'm saying to you is that the answer is there, and we have to get the answer out of the series. And then, once we're strong, once we understand how to accelerate the convergence of a series, we're going to talk about Fourier series, because, as I said to you before, Fourier series converge horribly, horribly slowly. Not always. They converge very rapidly when you're solving a trivial problem. But when you're solving an interesting problem, they converge terribly slowly. So the question is, how do we accelerate the convergence of a Fourier series? The slow convergence of a Fourier series is connected with the Gibbs phenomenon, How many of you have ever heard of a Gibbs phenomenon? Maybe about a third of you or something, okay? Many people think that a Gibbs phenomenon is something bad. It's a bad property of Fourier series. No, don't believe that. The Gibbs phenomenon is good. The Gibbs phenomenon is what allows you to use Fourier series to solve very hard problems. But you pay for it. The Gibbs phenomenon has to do with the non-uniform convergence of a Fourier series. Non-uniform convergence results from slow convergence. We're going to learn how to sum the series very, very quickly. And we're going to overcome the Gibbs phenomenon using acceleration of convergence methods. Then I'm going to show you how to sum divergent series. And I'm going to show you that the sum of a divergent series is very easy often to extract. And the techniques that I'm going to use here are Pade theory, continued fractions, continued functions in general. These are very, very powerful techniques. And these are the techniques that justify teaching you perturbation theory in the first place. Okay? So that's what this course is about. How to solve problems. How to solve very hard problems. Okay? And I'm going to justify the fact that you've been taught, and that you will be taught in the future, perturbation theory. For example, summing Feynman diagrams is doing perturbation theory. If you don't know that you can do Pade theory, the mindless summation of Feynman diagrams is a complete waste of time. And that's because sums of Feynman diagrams are always divergent. Always. Absolutely always. So it's absolutely crucial to justify what you do when you solve a hard problem by learning how to sum a series. Okay? So that's what this course is about. And we will begin the hard work next time. Okay?